A wise man once said, every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end. Just kidding, that was 90s alt-rock band Semisonic from their hit song Closing Time, which, incidentally, was at the center of a 2003 Camp Ramah color war mishap involving a broken keyboard and my co-captain Oren yelling at the camp director, what do you want me to do, pay for it with my bar mitzvah money? Good times. Anyway, every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end is a great line, and an apt theme for this, my final address to you this season, my dear listeners. As I have throughout the past 9 challenging months, I want to use the opportunity of being beamed directly into your ears, or your car, or your living room, to leave you with a charge. One that I hope will spur you to a new beginning, perhaps over the summer months until we come together like this again. Today's episode is all about leadership, a theme well explored throughout Jewish tradition. If I had to describe the way I try to be a leader, I'd break it down into 2 pillars: modeling and empowerment. First, you model. You walk the walk so that others may observe it. Then you empower, challenging others to walk the path as well. If I can do it, so can you. It's not a paradigm of leader and follower. It's leader inspiring leader. That is what I've tried to build this show to accomplish. And if the messages I have received from you all over the course of this season are any indication, it's working. You're doing it. So today, I want to offer you some inspiration, not from me, but from your fellow members of our BJJP community who have answered the call and are already making a difference. One such listener is Ravit, who teaches preschool children with autism. She wrote to me saying that each morning during circle time, we greet each other, share how we're feeling, and sing songs to learn the days of the week, months of the year, and more. We use an online calendar powered by Starfall to reinforce these concepts. The platform includes graphics for various holidays, and this year, I noticed that while the December calendar marked the first night of Hanukkah, it didn't include a menorah graphic, only a Christmas tree, though the holidays fell on the same night. I felt uncomfortable with this, and decided to reach out to Starfall and express my concern. The next day, I received a reply letting me know they had found a solution. Now both a Christmas tree and a menorah would appear on the calendar. I was moved to tears. This all happened because of the confidence your podcast has given me. You've reminded me that my voice matters and that speaking up can lead to change. Shout out to Ravit. Another listener named Amy wrote to tell me about an opinion piece full of anti-Semitic tropes and misinformation that was to be included in her local public high school yearbook. The school board set a meeting to discuss the article, and to quote Amy, I was very torn on if I wanted to attend the meeting. It is not easy for me to speak up on difficult topics. On my way to work, I listened to your show, and I realized I had to go, and I had to speak. In my written comments, I had used anti-Semitism to describe something, but there was a large, vocal Muslim presence at the meeting, and many of them spoke that they were Semites. So I remembered what you said and changed anti-Semitism to Jewish hate. I followed up with the superintendent today and used that language again. I know that my words had an impact, and I felt really proud for speaking up. Shout out to you, Amy. I feel proud too. 76-year-old Rochelle, a PhD living in Georgia, emailed me to say that the guests and I have, quote, ignited her own learning journey. I am now studying with my local Chabad and embarking on a women's Torah study group, as well as participating in other standalone Jewish history and or contemporary topical sessions and reading profusely. Shout out to Dr. Rochelle. Instagram follower Rebecca messaged me to say that the podcast has been absolutely transformative for her and her husband. We have talked about Jewish day school for future kids, and the dialogue your show has prompted has led us to meet on the same page, in agreement that a Jewish education for our children is critical. Shout out to Rebecca and her hubby, and those future kids. Get cracking. An educator named Eliza reached out to say, I run a Jewish nonprofit focused on accurate K-12 education about Jews, Judaism, and Jewish history, including Israel. I wanted to let you know that I have brought insights from your monologues to our team and our work. We train over 4,000 6th through 12th grade educators in non-Jewish schools in all 50 states. In one lesson, we replaced a lot of references to anti-Semitism with anti-Jew hate. So this will benefit those educators, and by extension, their hundreds of thousands of students. And we intend to scale our training, so in the next 2 years, we will train 15,000 teachers a year. I'm grateful for your message, which helped us do a better job of teaching teachers. Shout out to Aliza and all her colleagues. One listener, Kelsey, DM'd me to let me know that she had taken, quote, a big step. Remember when you had Patricia Heaton on your podcast? Well, I ordered my first mezuzah and hung it today. Your podcast has been helping me move forward and further immerse myself in the traditions and culture, and it's making me feel as though I'm home. Shout out to you, Kelsey. Welcome home. And last, but certainly not least, a young woman named Danielle DM'd me to inform me she was doing a month-long volunteer trip to Israel. I've never been, she said. I'm leaving my family and going on my own. Since 10/7, I've been volunteering at home, but I felt I need to help in any way possible in Israel, so I'm going. And with no medical experience, I'll be volunteering with Magen David Adom. Please know how you have inspired me to make a difference. I had the opportunity to meet Danielle at a speaking event after her service abroad, and I let her know how inspiring her bravery and leadership were to me. Major shout out to Danielle. The first monologue I ever wrote for this show in episode 1 is called Why This Podcast Exists. When I wrote it, I outlined the things I wanted to accomplish. Normalizing Jews talking about Jewish stuff, creating a safe space for honest conversations, and an exploration of the beautiful mosaic of Jewish identity. I feel confident we have checked all those boxes. But as I reflect on where I am now and my hope for our shared future, I realize that on a macro level, the big why of this podcast is entirely about you. The show is my attempt to utilize my specific skill set, knowledge, and sphere of influence to promote a prouder, stronger, healthier Jewish and allied community through you. You have always been this other part of this equation, and it is your actions that continue to inspire me. So that's the final challenge. Inspire me. Take whatever nugget of this show has most sparked a fire in you and use it. Do something with it. Use your skill set, your knowledge, and your sphere of influence, whether it's 100 followers, a professional network, your kids, or your Uncle Greg, to somehow promote a prouder, stronger, healthier Jewish and allied community. You are capable. You have the capacity to lead, and all that is required to do so is already within you. Inspire me so I can continue to hopefully inspire you in a brilliant positive feedback loop that grows and grows until its ripples are felt all over the world, creating change together as a community that none of us could ever have imagined alone. Don't wait for permission and don't lose heart. And if you do get stuck, I'm always here to back you up. So go be leaders. And then make sure to tell me about it so I can tell you how proud I am of you. It's time to level up, y'all. A new chapter in your life starts now. It's like a wise man once said, every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end. So, begin. This is the 40th episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. Episode 40. Golly, can't believe we are here for the final episode of the inaugural season of Being Jewish. What a blessing. And it's going to be a great episode because we have a very, very special guest joining me today. But first, today's season finale has been generously sponsored by Jeff and Leslie Wallman, who have been chosen family to me, my parents, my siblings, and our extended family for over 30 years. Jeff and Leslie, I love you. Thank you so much for your support now and always. Now, the time has come to introduce my illustrious guest. She is a leader in every sense of the word, a true multiplier who uses her inextinguishable flame to ignite others, never as a means of drawing focus to herself. She is admired and respected by every person she meets, which is a lot of people, and I know this because they all tell me. She has held lay leadership positions in organizations across the country, including her just completed 3-year term as chairwoman of Jewish Federations of North America, a role that saw her lead the diaspora's largest Jewish philanthropic organization through the outbreak of the Ukraine war, the horrors of October 7th, and all that has followed. She has been a steady hand in the unsteadiest of times, raised nearly $1 billion of emergency relief for Israel, and was recognized with the Presidential Medal of Honor, the highest civilian distinction Israel can bestow. Also, she's my mom. Please welcome the most beloved Platt by far, Julie Platt.
Thanks, Jonah. That was such a nice introduction. Thank you.
Happy to have you here, Mom.
Thank you.
To bring us home, season one.
Thank you.
So as I mentioned, you just finished your term as chairwoman of JFN. Are you even officially out of the role?
I'm not officially out yet. Not till July 1st.
Okay. So I know you had your goodbye appreciation dinner. How are you feeling about coming to the end of this road?
That it's not the end of the road. First of all, none of us in Jewish leadership, whether lay or professional, have the opportunity to say, I'm done. We can't be done.
Right.
So I'm not done.
What does that mean? What's next?
What it means for me is that I will hold on to several of the initiatives that I steered because I believe in them and because it's a heavy lift right now, most primarily security. I was honored to chair something called Live Secure.
Okay.
Which its genesis was really after the Tree of Life shooting mm-hmm. in Pittsburgh, but it came to full fruition over the 3 years in which I was chair, which was to lift up the professionalism of community security across the Federation system. So I chaired a fundraising campaign of $62 million that was used as a matching fund for our federations and to empower the Secure Community Network to professionalize community security, to make sure that we have the best, the most coordinated, the highest level of security, and we're not done, even though the first phase is over. So I will continue to help lead, not only to make sure it is at that level, but to raise more funds because communities need more security, unfortunately.
So what does that look like? Like, what kind of places are getting more security? What does more security mean?
It's every communal Jewish space. So it's day schools and day camps and JCCs, and every place Jews gather have to be overseen by a professional security organization.
Right. Any other major things that you've left unfinished that you're going to continue to steer?
I will certainly be part of raising the funds needed to address the crisis that has arisen from the Iran war.
In terms of disaster relief.
That's exactly right. There's a lot of need right now.
Oh, yeah.
More than we ever could have imagined. And we are mobilizing. One of the other things that I will continue to be involved in is this new or enhanced relationship between Birthright and Jewish Federations of North America in terms of voluntourism. You think of it as Birthright trips.
Right.
And I know you went on a Birthright
trip. I sure
did. We want to expand the age of people who will go and volunteer in Israel, multi-generational, people in the middle of their life who have the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we are very much working on and have really grown volunteer opportunities between JFNA and Birthright to go volunteer and be helpful to the people of Israel.
Is there like a title for this new position you'll be in?
Immediate past chair.
Immediate past chair.
That's right. And I'll continue to chair Live Secure.
Fantastic. How have your priorities shifted from when you came into this role 3 years ago and thought, here's what I'm going to try to tackle, and then all of this balagan happens, and now you have new priorities? Obviously, security is a major one. And you mentioned, you know, now we have this relief that Israel needs. But what about big picture?
I'll give you a great example. At the moment, we're calling it Live Together. I'm also going to chair this initiative.
Sounds like you're really slowing down, Mom.
We didn't imagine the whack-a-mole of needs at the community level that would arise because of anti-Semitism. So fighting in school boards, city councils, affecting change in K-12 curriculum, that was just not on our bingo card.
Mm.
And now it is. The federations are clamoring for help. And one of the things that we can do is to, again, raise funds and expertise. We have really beefed up our professional response, and we will raise funds to enable federations to hire more professionals. They can't handle all of this.
Professionals who will be sort of civically, politically oriented.
And educationally oriented, who can write curriculum.
Mm. So speaking of civic engagement, politics, you've been engaged with many different politicians through all your various roles. In what ways do you like to be involved politically? Like, where do you try to influence things and in pursuit of what goals right now?
So one of those things I've done during my spare time is join the National Board of AIPAC. And I did that because I truly believe in bipartisan support, mm-hmm. and I wanted to be part of that. I have for a very long time with a dear and close friend run a political network here in Los Angeles with the express purpose of bipartisan support
for
Israel. And coincidentally, and though we didn't see it, making sure there are loud statements against anti-Semitism.
Right.
I have some wonderful relationships that I have grown out of necessity mm-hmm. over the past 3 or 4 years. They are now my friends who I can call upon in a very personal way to say, I need you, and I need you to say something. And I need you to say that what happened in Boulder, Colorado, and what happened in Washington, D.C. is just not okay, and to please speak loudly. And I'm proud of those relationships, and I will continue to work to grow them.
Okay, so now we've done the little check-in about what's going on now. Now I want to go back to the beginning and sort of paint the picture of how we got here. And I want to start all the way back in Wichita, Kansas, where you were born. Not a lot of people know that unless they know you personally. I think most people assume that our whole family's from LA, and I enjoy getting to tell people that I'm the first Platt to be born in LA.
That's
So you grew up in Wichita. You were the only Jewish kid in your graduating class of almost 700 people. As a kid, how much did you feel or were aware of this minority status?
I felt it in a prideful way, not in a negative way. I was asked so many questions and explained so many times why I was taking off school for what random holiday. I had a deeply beautiful Jewish home that my parents made sure that they provided for us. I am often asked if I experienced anti-Semitism. Once.
That's pretty good.
Pretty great. I had a sixth grade teacher, Mrs. McGrew.
You're on notice, Mrs. McGrew.
Who made the statement in front of the class that she would not cast her pearls before swine. And I was the swine that she was referring to.
What does that mean, cast her pearls?
Her wisdom, her educational prowess.
Oh my God.
To me. That was...
It's terrible.
The one really bad experience I had.
And what? How did you react to that?
I don't exactly remember what happened in that moment other than the upset I shared with my parents, and I was on the way out of that school. I think they would have moved me had I not been. Mm. I will tell you a beautiful story about Wichita, which is I had the opportunity to lead the rally in November of 2023 in Washington.
300,000
300,000, the largest gathering of North American Jewry in our history. And when it was over, I had the opportunity to speak on CNN and on Fox about the rally. They had my name, obviously, on a
chyron on the bottom.
Exactly. And it said, Chair, Jewish Federations of North America. Three of my high school friends from Wichita looked up where that was, what that was, wrote handwritten letters to me, sent them to the office. They then sent him to me saying, I hope you remember us from Wichita. We stand by you. We stand by the state of Israel. And we were so proud to see you.
That's so nice.
Oh, my gosh.
Were they people you remembered?
I'll remember them forever for that incredible act of kindness.
So you mentioned your parents and what incredible Jewish community leaders they were. Can you pinpoint any sort of specific takeaways that you learned in how to be a leader from both your mother, Joan, and your father, Robert?
People ask me this all the time, like, why do you do this? Or where did it come from? I don't remember it being a choice. I remember it being organic. This is what you do. Mm-hmm. So my husband, Mark, your father, told a story last week at that gathering you referenced about our senior year of college when others might be going out on a lovely date to recognize their senior year. And we went out to solicit because I was chairing the UJ campaign at the University of Pennsylvania. It just always was. I know that probably seems hard to imagine, but I never imagined that I would do anything other than be a Jewish leader. I never even thought, should I or shouldn't I? It was just like, you go to high school, you go to college, you become a Jewish communal leader. I always knew I would, and my siblings.
I was just going to mention,
100%.
All three of your siblings have done the exact same thing. So
done
it's
the
clearly
exact same thing.
In the water at your house.
Done the exact same thing. I mean, it was such a joy for me that my sister Amy was leading the New York Federation as I began leading the LA Federation, and then JFNA, we were doing all these things at the exact same time on the two coasts.
Yeah.
And have worked together so closely. My brother, as you know, leads CAM, the Combating Anti-Semitism. And my sister Nancy is deeply engaged both in the Houston Jewish community and in Israel.
Right. You were going to give me a specific example, I think.
Right. So Jewish values aren't just in the synagogue and in your home. My father, in a moment I won't ever forget, as the chair of the school board in Wichita, Kansas, was very involved and led the integration of the school system in Wichita, Kansas. First, I remember putting up street placards for my father when he was running.
I have one in my office.
I know you do. I remember that like it was yesterday. We put them together in the basement and then drove around and put them up in neighborhoods all over Wichita. And then I remember distinctly that this was one of the most important things to my father, was busing and integration of the school system. A beautiful Jewish value realized in a very different sphere.
Amazing. So now let's get to Jewish camp.
Okay.
Okay. So in Wichita, you're the only Jew in your class. But then in the summertime, you get to go to Camp Ramah in Ojai, California, where I also went, and all my brothers and sisters and all my cousins, after you and all of your brothers and sisters and cousins went. Now my nephews are all there. Your grandkids are going. You've called it like going to Disneyland for you. What does that mean?
I mean, everywhere I turned were Jews my age. I just couldn't get over it. I got to have friends my age who were Jewish.
What was so important about that?
I didn't have any. And I felt the organic connection I feel to the Jewish people, even at my age and at my level. I had a best friend who you, of course, knew, who sadly passed away, Debbie Barrick, who I met as a 12-year-old. The depth of my friendship with Debbie was just different. It was just completely different than my friends in Wichita, because we had this shared heritage and shared set of values. But I'll also say that something else about it, which is I think I learned a lot about parenting at Jewish summer camp. And I have reflected on this before. And interestingly enough, Debbie's sister-in-law was my first camp counselor and the camp counselor for Debbie and I in our bunk. And every night before she put us to bed, she sat on the bunk of every child in that class. And I knew she had a boyfriend at camp and she was probably desperate to get out the door, but she didn't. And she sat with each of us to review and process whatever had happened to us during that day and to really speak to us on a very personal level, sort of in an intimate way. And I felt so understood by her. Mm. And I always tried to follow that with my own children.
That's so nice. Famously, at Camp Ramah, they do musicals all throughout the summer, all of which are in Hebrew. I was in Fiddler on the Roof. I played Tevye in Hebrew. That's like a whole another level. I did The Wiz in Hebrew. I know you were in Damn Yankees, famously.
I was.
You played Lola.
I did.
And you still remember it.
I do.
Can you give us a little phrase?
Shtei neshamot avudot. It was the two lost souls.
Two lost souls.
Or I'm thinking about Bye Bye Birdie. I mean,
oh, you remember Bye Bye Birdie.
Shalom Birdie, lehitraot motek. I mean, I do remember. What was I? 13?
It's amazing. 14? I remember Lu Hayiti Rothschild. You've referred this before in conversation with me, that there is data on the impact of Jewish camp on forming Jewish identity. Can you speak about what those findings have been?
So I gave it to you anecdotally, but right. It's the truth. And this is not to besmudge any other Jewish experience. I think everybody should have immersive experiences in Israel. I believe and fight for and help fund Jewish day school education. Mm-hmm. But there's some secret sauce that happens at Jewish summer camp. It is that Jewish joyful experience. It's gathering in white on Friday night and singing together as you usher in Shabbat. There is just something sticky about Jewish summer camp, and it proves out. People lighting candles, living Jewish lives, engaging in their communities, synagogue membership, day school enrollment. You can often trace it to data points of Jewish summer camp. It's just true. It's not a myth.
If I had to categorize it, I would put it under the heading of immersion. I mean, I think that's
right.
What makes it so sticky, to use your word, is even with day school, even with a trip to Israel, those things are more limited. After school, you go home, and Israel is a limited amount of time or whatever it is. But when you're at camp, from the morning you wake up till the moment you go to sleep, it's all Jewish all the time, surrounded by Jews, and you don't get that anywhere else.
That's exactly correct. That's a beautiful way to describe it.
So talking about camp in this way and how important it is, how is it 2025 and we still haven't made it financially viable for every single Jew who wants to go to camp?
I think we've moved the needle, to be sure. Mm-hmm. One particular program, so in those Jewish communal positions I've held, one of them was chair of Foundation for Jewish Camp, which if you have not heard of it, I'm glad you'll hear about it now. But I would make it analogous to sort of Hillel International, which oversees all of the Hillels across the country. Foundation for Jewish Camp tries to lift up and hold and help Jewish summer camps all over North America. We instigated something called One Happy Camper a very long time ago. We funded it in matches with Jewish federations around the country to incentivize Jewish summer camp. We provide scholarships.
Sure.
And I do think we've moved the needle and helped people understand that, particularly based on the data we just talked about you want to ensure Jewish future, send your kid to Jewish summer camp.
Right. So obviously you've moved the needle, but we're not all the way there yet. Why do you think that is when it's so clear, and especially, you know, what we're seeing today with how important it is to have strong, confident, well-rounded Jewish identity for people in the times that we're living in, when camp is an important piece of that foundational puzzle?
The problem is, those of us who are lucky to be on the giving side are being asked by our day schools to move a giant needle, mm-hmm. which will require way more resources, to fund the trips to Israel I just talked about, to fund the needs in their community, and to fund Jewish summer camp. So I think if I was sitting here and you were talking to me as the head of Prisma, which oversees the day school movement, or Hillel International, which oversees all the Hillels, or as chair of JFNA, which I still am, the call upon resources each person believes is the most important call, and it tends to be a very big bucket of giving that is needed. What I find the bigger challenge, even than the funding, which I know is very important and I will continue to work on it for the rest of my life, is that we haven't moved the needle of penetration in Jewish summer camping. It's still, and you could, I'm not sure what the number is because I pay attention to the West Coast, but nationally, but it's probably 10%.
Of what?
Of eligible Jewish kids are going to Jewish summer camp. I'm really talking about nonprofit Jewish summer camp. We still are not the majority of Jewish kids going to summer camp. And of course, many of them care about their athletic abilities or their performing arts abilities in hopes of moving on their passions and dreams into high school and college. I get that. Mm-hmm. We can't be all things to all people, although we try to, because right. We need to be good at everything. But I wish more kids just went to Jewish summer camp.
So you've been the Ramah Ohai board chair. You've been the chair, as you mentioned, of the Foundation for Jewish Camp. During COVID, do you really know how to pick your moments?
I know.
How stressful was that?
Oh my God, it was just awful. It was literally awful because these camps and their professional staff survive on summer tuition, and we refunded it all across North America.
Did you lose a whole summer?
Some lost one summer, some lost two summers who didn't feel, and their parents didn't feel they had the COVID protocol necessary to bring their kids back in very close quarters. Wow. You're living with your friends in your summer camp. It was awful. We lost a few camps that closed forever because they didn't have the financial backing and resources and reserves.
Yeah.
It was such a loss leader, a complete loss leader for a summer and a loss leader for the second summer. We're back.
Fully rebounded?
Fully rebounded.
Amazing.
Fully rebounded and overflowing with campers.
Are you seeing an uptick?
Yes, we are.
That's great.
Which is wonderful. It's what we refer to as the surge, right. a phrase coined by Jewish Federations of North America. More kids want to go and be in community with their fellow Jews.
So let's talk a little bit more specifically about Jewish Federation. It's obviously been a major topic of this discussion so far, but I want to talk more about your involvement with it on a personal level. You mentioned that you were soliciting for the UJA campaign while you were in college. Like, where does that come from? How did that start?
I had watched my parents lead both locally and nationally. I believed in the Federation system at 18 the same way I do now at 68 almost. I very much believe in what the Federation system can do, even more so since October 7th. I am so proud of what we do. I believe in it. I put my funding behind it and our family's funding behind it. I won't ever walk away. So many people have said, like, what's your next chapter? And I just keep saying, like, the same chapter it's been for 50 years, which is I believe in what we can accomplish. There are wonderful things happening across North America in Jewish communal organizations, and I'm part of many of them. Mm-hmm. But where my focus has been and will continue to be is the Federation system.
If you had to encapsulate what the Federation does in a line or two, what's the log line?
We are able to convene in 140 plus communities at a moment's notice to imbue professional expertise to help communities feel safe and secure and educated and engaged. And more than anything, to try to support them in every way we can, whether it's through data, through marketing and communications, through physical security, through community relations expertise, to also have flourishing Jewish communities. It's not just enough to have a Jewish community. It's to have all those things that make you have a flourishing Jewish community.
I give $10 to Federation. What does Federation do with that $10?
We do a lot of things with your $10.
I know.
So we fund our key partners in Israel, the Jewish Agency for Israel, the JDC, the Joint Distribution Committee, on which my sister Amy is deeply engaged. And JDC operates in countries around the world. So when you give a Federation gift, you are helping what we do in Israel, what the Jewish Agency for Israel does in Israel, what JDC does in Israel, what JDC does around the world, and what we do in North America, and what we do in your local community. That all happens through a gift to the Federation.
Amazing. You were only the second woman ever to be JFNA chair after former Congresswoman Kathy Manning. Did your gender come into play at all during your tenure?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'll say a few things. First, I hope someday the second question people ask me after they say, what's your next chapter, which is, what did it feel like to be the second mm-hmm. leader of Jewish Federations of North America, will be commonplace.
Right.
And there'll be lots more who follow me. And no, I will never run for Congress, because that's often the third chair. Are you going to follow Kathy and run for Congress? Nope.
Which I'm glad to hear.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I want very much for this to be two-pronged. One, that more women raise their hands. Everywhere I go, particularly when I'm speaking to women leaders, that some of it is on us. You have to put your hand up and say, I want the next position in the general campaign, in Federation leadership, not just in women's leadership, so that we are side by side with seats at the table. That's often on us. But unfortunately, it's also, and I have experienced personally, a question of whether a woman leader will be as strong, as critical, as loud when needed as a male counterpart. I hope I have spent the last 3 years putting that to rest. I will continue to do so, where it's not about my gender, it's just about my ability to lead.
I love that answer. So it's been an eventful 3 years, to put it mildly.
Put it mildly.
So first you come in on the heels of COVID.
That's right.
What have you learned broadly about the Jewish community as you were coming in? Anything that you were able to develop because of COVID that you guys are still holding on to?
So two great things came out of necessity. One is something we called at the time, I think, JCRIF. It was the Jewish Communal Response something. We brought together the heads of the major Jewish organizations and sat at the same table by Zoom on a constant basis saying, we got to do this together. What can we do? How can we organize around PPE loans? How can we help? What is needed in this moment? That now continues as something called Jewish Together, which I don't think would have happened before, where the heads of all those Jewish communal organizations come together and talk all the time about the fight against anti-Semitism, the response to Israel, all the things that are needed. And we do it together. And Federation has convened that, and I'm very proud of that.
I think the perception is in the wider Jewish community that these major Jewish organizations do not communicate and do not work together at all.
And we do. And I want to dispel that.
Can you give me an example of how that's manifested after one of these meetings of something you all have then done together in concert?
The rally. That's a really good example for you. That was everybody. Our partner in this was something called the Conference of Presidents. That's the presidents of all the major Jewish organizations, and there are dozens. But that organization helped us to mobilize 300,000 people. And there was not like, who's going to take the credit and which organization gets to sponsor it. And it was just all hands on deck. And we have done that repeatedly.
How do we hold on to that even when it's not an acute crisis?
Something maybe that you wouldn't expect me to answer is everybody being clear what their mission is. And I think we've tried really hard to make people do that. What we do is different than what ADL does, and that's different than what AJC does, and that's different than the Foundation for Jewish Camp. So we work very hard on that, of everybody understanding what their role is and then using it together for response to these kind of moments. I don't find the disagreements that maybe we saw many years ago out of necessity, sadly, but I think people are really trying to row in the same direction in their own mission statements.
Obviously, there's still a lot of overlap.
There is.
So let's say it's combating anti-Semitism. I mean, there's like 20 organizations that say they're combating anti-Semitism. And it feels like that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's bad if we have 20 different action plans for how to combat anti-Semitism instead of one or two that are all happening together. How do we work with that?
It's challenging, Jonah.
Of course.
So we have often said everybody's got to throw their ideas out in this moment. We don't have the luxury of not listening to somebody who has a new idea or who has a way to combat anti-Semitism. What we don't need to do is publicly argue with each other. There's probably nothing I hate more than seeing somebody say, well, they don't know what they're doing, or we know how to do it better. ADL's doing this, and I don't agree with that. Actually, we have to have deep respect because everybody's trying to get it right. There are times we will overlap and where we can do things together, and there's times where we won't, and what they're doing has nothing to do with what JFNA does. What we are trying to do is to convene the table, so that everybody knows what everybody's doing, so that we can try to work together. It is not foolproof. And infighting, I think, is our worst look.
Oh, yeah.
And I really hope everybody listening to this will say airing our dirty laundry and infighting and calling out members of the Jewish community publicly is just no help at all.
I'm reminded of something. So for a number of years, I sponsored a stem cell symposium series at University of California, San Francisco.
I remember.
I wanted to support stem cell research because of how important it is. And something that the professionals there identified as being an issue was sort of the siloed nature of scientific research, that somebody in Germany is working on this one thing, somebody in California is working on this one thing, and if they're never brought together, they just don't know what each other is doing. So by doing this sort of symposium series, we were able to bring people from all over the world together, and a lot of amazing partnerships sort of came out of that. You mentioned you're convening, you've got this new together thing. Is there room for more of that?
So it's interesting you would say that, because prior to coming to speak with you today, I was on a call on this topic. But the topic was about the messaging. When something happens, we're so far behind in the coordinating messaging that we've seen from the other side, from the anti-Israel, anti-Semitism, or the Jew hate side of this.
Right, right.
So what would it look like if overnight the smartest minds were part of a messaging hub? And when something bad happens, they convened in real time. And by the time you woke up the next morning, if you were at any of the places where messaging comes from, you were part of a messaging hub, and everybody had the same talking points, and everybody sent out the same message the next day. That's what we're going to try to do.
I think that's amazing.
We don't necessarily have the answer of what the messaging will
be.
We ought to bring together people who do this really well, so that we're not like 2 weeks later saying, well, what should we say about what happened? But that by the time you wake up, you have the talking points.
I think that'd be fantastic.
We're going to try to do that.
Right on. So back to your time at JFNA. You start with COVID, then you get the outbreak of the Ukraine war because things weren't interesting enough for you during your time. What can you tell me about that period of your leadership?
One of the things that I often say when I'm out speaking to communities is that unlike any time in Jewish history, any Jew who needed to be rescued from Ukraine was rescued from Ukraine. So we were able to immediately, because I'll tell you another analogy we use all the time, and this is coined by the president and CEO of Jewish Federations of North America, Eric Fingerhut, is you don't build fire stations for a fire. You have them in place so that all you have to do is turn on the spigot. We had the fire departments across Ukraine and across all the places that refugees needed to go to get out of Ukraine so that all we had to do was turn on the spigot. So in no time at all, Jews who needed to get out of there, and it was women and children because the men were not allowed to leave, we got them where they needed to go fast and safely. And then because we had the fire department in Ukraine, we could provide all the resources needed on the ground to those behind. So I felt incredibly proud of our work. And with the partnership actually of the First Lady of Ukraine and with the First Lady of the State of Israel and with me, we convened a group of philanthropists to say what's needed that we're not addressing that we don't see, and to do some very private and serious funding on the ground in Ukraine.
Amazing. Then obviously the biggest disaster, October 7th happens. You immediately jump into crisis relief mode. And I think the tally at this point is 850 million. Is
that We're right? almost at 900 million.
Almost
That's
at 900
right. But it's moving very fast right this minute because everybody's reactivated. Mm. And the money is just going fast and furiously into Israel right now.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. What has been the hardest part of this job that you've done for the last 3 years?
Probably an answer you're not expecting me to give unless you're going to go on to Penn at some point in your questions.
Penn's next.
That's the hardest thing I've ever done.
So let's get to the Mishigas at Penn. Under then-President Liz McGill, sort of starts with this Palestinian Rights Festival situation and Penn's handling of that. And then, of course, October 7th happens. Famously, the president's brought in front of Congress, doesn't say the right thing, to put it mildly. Eventually is ousted. I think, at least from my conversations with you, and you can say if I'm correct or not, that, you know, Liz McGill was just sort of the wrong person at the wrong time, not necessarily a, you know, a bad actor or nefarious person.
I know Liz. I call her a friend.
Of course.
She is no Jew hater.
Right.
She is a friend of the Jewish people. I think she was caught in a moment. Who is to blame for that moment is not important. She was caught in a moment and was never able to recover from it. And it was clear in an instant that she was not going to be able to recover from it and that we had to make a change and she had to make a change. I was happened to be in a position to be very much part of that moment as vice chair of the board, as you know, mm-hmm. for about 28 days, I was the chair of the board of the University of Pennsylvania because it was automatic when both the chair and the president resigned in a moment. I got to be part of the decision to lift up the incredible president of the University of Pennsylvania right now, Dr. Larry Jamison, and the incredible chair of our board, Ramanan Raghavendran. And I feel completely confident that we are not in that moment now and that we have the leadership both of our president and of our chair to take us out of this moment. And I think we're fairly far along that path.
What was the most brutal aspect that you endured in those couple months?
I'm loath to say this because it's being Jewish with Jonah Platt, but I received more hate from my Jewish community than from any other community at the role I decided to take at Penn, the way I decided to handle it, which, as you know, follows the adage of Ann Richards, the mm-hmm. governor of Texas, if you don't have a seat at the table, you're on the menu for lunch. That's what I decided to do, was to double down, along with several very significant Jewish leaders who found themselves on the executive committee and the board in this moment, who partnered with me, along with our non-Jewish trustees who were never at odds with me or with their fellow Jewish trustees, not for 1 minute.
in my work, you know, the nastiest people are definitely from the Jewish community. It's where I get the most, the hate that irks me the most and I find to be the most sort of baffling.
Startling.
I know at one point, you know, you were basically getting doxxed. I mean, you were getting thousands of emails. What did they not understand that you wish these folks would have understood that, you know, obviously if they had spoken to you face to face in 30 seconds, they probably would have understood?
The values that drew me to Penn, that kept me engaged as a trustee for 20 years, are exactly the same. This is a very troubling time. It was a very difficult moment on Penn's campus, on campuses around the country. There was no playbook for this. We'd never seen anything like it before. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we figured out the playbook, which was as simple as the enforcement of time, place, and manner, everything started to turn. Mm-hmm. You know, people say, but there were encampments all across North America and you were failing us all across North America. I don't know the exact numbers, but I think there's 3,000 maybe colleges or institutions of higher learning in North America. The number of encampments was a fraction of that. But our lovely social media made you feel like every Jewish student on every Jewish campus all across North America was cowering in their dormitory room. It just wasn't the case. It was just what you saw was terrifying. And what we had to impress upon the leadership at these universities, in Penn's case, under President Jameson, with very little difficulty, he saw it the same as I did and as my fellow trustees, was just follow the rules. Decisions have consequences. There were going to be consequences. Whether your listeners know about it or not, there have been consequences. People were denied diplomas, and their future employers know it.
How are you personally or through JFNA attempting to tackle these deep-seated ideological issues we're seeing on college campuses?
So, of course, one of the biggest challenges we have seen and has been uncovered lies within the faculty. And anybody who understands how universities work know that there is a great decision-making ability that happens within the faculty senate and around tenure. That isn't a spigot that can be turned on and off at will. That takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of conversations around what I would consider some very loud bad actors in university faculty, shedding a bright light on those members of our faculty, giving their fellow decision makers in the faculty the support that they need. But I'm going to tell you an answer you probably would not imagine I would give, which is in my double down segment, which is, so fund at universities, fund chairs in Jewish studies, fund Middle East study professorships, fund Penn Hillels, fund your Hillel, fund where you went, where you live, in the community where you now find yourself.
I've said the very thing on the show.
Fund them. You can help all these things happen. The change in the composition of faculty, but it takes funding.
What kind of impact do you feel like you were able to have in those 28 days as the interim board president?
I am not responsible for the choosing of our chair or the choosing of our president, but I was loud as loud can be, leading a process for the chair and in leading a process for the president, along with lay leadership of the University of Pennsylvania. So I feel very proud of the role I played. Many people think I just handpicked Ramanan and it was all my decision and they had no say in it. That's not how it went at all. But I did lead a process along with my professional colleagues of how it would go, that we would do it real quick because we needed leadership and I wanted out. I didn't want out because at some other day and some other time, wouldn't have considered being the chair of the University of Pennsylvania, but I was the chair of Jewish Federations of North America, and that had to come first, and I couldn't do them both. I couldn't emotionally handle it,
yeah,
and I couldn't physically handle it. So I needed it to happen fast.
What about in terms of the Federation stuff?
I think just emotional stamina. I, along with my professional colleagues and my lay colleagues, have cried more, I think, in the last 2 years than I ever have as a leader. Cried over the good we do and cried over the suffering that we're watching in the Middle East. I'm more fragile emotionally than I've ever been.
It's a lot of trauma.
It's a lot of trauma.
What's been the most rewarding part of the last couple of years?
I've traveled to 50 communities since I became chair. It doesn't matter if I'm in Augusta, Georgia, where their whole community leaders are 40 people who come together and have dinner with me, or New York UJA, or the Los Angeles Federation, which I'm with all the time. It doesn't matter. Everybody's hearts are exactly the same. And I'm so inspired by the people who are doing this, who have run out of steam and won't let it stop, both professional and lay. I'm deeply inspired by that. And that's what fuels me.
That's beautiful. Everywhere that you've ever been in life that's meant anything to you, as an adult, you've turned around and been on their board or chaired it or volunteered there. We even found a Jewish phrase that seems to exemplify that, which is hakarat hatov, recognizing the good, a conscious appreciation, being loyal or kind in return to someone that helped you. You're on the board at Penn, Ramah. You're on the board of your kid's high school. You're on the board of the hospital where your kids were born. What do you make of that?
That's such a good question, because I've thought about it a lot, particularly since I went on the board of Cedars.
Right.
Cedars-Sinai Medical Center here in Los Angeles. It's the model of the grateful patient. That's where I learned it.
What does that mean?
When you receive great care or great influence in your life, you want to say thank you. And I've been lucky enough to be on the thank you side. And that's what fuels everything I do. So when they asked me to be on the Cedars board, they safely delivered my children and safely delivered my grandchildren, took care of my father. I'm so grateful. I want to give back to the places that have been wonderful to me. Jewish summer camp, are you kidding? I couldn't wait to get on that board and then ultimately to chair it and then chair Foundation for Jewish Camp, because I'm so grateful. And the same applies to Federation. They are holding up Jewish communities worldwide. And I'm so grateful for that. So I want to lead with gratitude. And that's why I do it. Exactly.
My last couple of questions don't necessarily have a unifying theme other than they're things I'm curious about and wanted to ask you. So this is the questions that Jonah wants to know section.
Okay.
Most people absolutely hate soliciting money. You're excellent at it. What's your approach?
You have to believe in what you're asking money for. So I won't ever ask for money for something I don't truly believe in. I can't fund everything. So you're going to have to join me. And because I want the mission, the project, the initiative to be funded, and I can't do it all myself, and I believe in it, I'm not afraid to ask you to help me do it. And I know how it feels when you've done it. I know the pride you take when you are part of seeing something come true or be funded or provided help. And I want to give you the opportunity to feel that way.
So if I may sort of tease out what I just heard as being the nugget that I think people can take away, it's really personalizing the ask. And it's not like, hey, this organization that I'm involved with needs some money. It's, I'm trying to accomplish this thing. Will you help me?
That's exactly right.
What was your experience being on the receiving end of me saying, Mom, I'm in love with a Catholic chick?
Oh, my God. Okay, that is really tough because I had already fallen in love with Courtney. So, like,
well, now you're saying.
No, you mean even when you first met her?
I mean at the very beginning, yeah. I don't mean now. Now she's, you know, queen of the Jews.
She is queen of the Jews. Weekly shout out to Courtney,
that's
right? So, maybe I'll say two things. Of course, it was my dream that all of my children would marry someone Jewish. And I would lie if I said that wasn't in my book of dreams of being a Jewish parent. I also thought I knew you, and I knew that no matter what might happen, you would find a way to raise Jewish children. So I think I knew that. But I think more than anything, and Jonah, this speaks to everything that's happening right now in the Jewish world, you are more important to me than any decision you will make about a spouse or how to lead your life or what your politics say or your practice of Judaism or your kashrut or anything you do. I want my family to stick together and be together and love each other, and that will win the day always.
I mean, that's beautiful. But I also want to know just sort of the truth of, like, when I said that, I mean, can you recall?
I freaked out. out.
Yeah. There we go. This is what I'm looking for.
Oh my God. Because I wanted Jewish grandchildren.
I'm pretty sure I would have said right away, like, I already mentioned conversion.
You
did. Right.
You did.
Did that calm you
of
at all?
Of course it did.
Okay, good. Okay.
It calmed me immediately.
You have 5 children. What the hell were you thinking?
Can I tell you a fast story about it?
Yeah.
So I came from 4. Right. I always imagined I'd have 4. Mm-hmm. That to me was like the right amount to have in a family. Mm-hmm. And then we were finished after Ben was born. And I was part of the Wexner Heritage Fellowship program.
Briefly tell me what that
is. It's a wonderful young leadership and learning program that is sponsored by and funded by the Wexners of Columbus, Ohio, who I now have the great opportunity to lead with in the larger Jewish community. And one of our last lectures after this program was from Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, who is one of my heroes in Jewish learning. And he looked out at this group of 40 leaders and said, I expect you all to go lead, and I expect you to find your place and your passion to lead. But if you really want to do something for the Jewish people and you have the resources and you feel you can handle it in your life, go have another Jewish child. And 3 of the families in that Wexner class have an extra child that they were never considering having because of Rabbi Greenberg's suggestion. And Henry Platt is the result of that.
What a gift to the Jewish people,
there
Henry Platt is.
There
Shout out
go.
To Henry. How do you approach Bibi Netanyahu? And what I mean by that is, you know, it's somebody who's very controversial, deeply unpopular in Israel and in parts of America, but you are, you know, the chairwoman of a major Jewish organization that has to engage with the prime minister of Israel. How do you juggle those considerations?
I don't actually interact with Prime Minister Netanyahu, much more with the minister of the diaspora. The ways in which we are funding, the stimulus we want to give to the government of Israel to partner with us in much we are doing in funding. But I would lie if I didn't say that just before October 7th, I was in Israel for the GA, for the 75th birthday of the State of Israel.
I was there too.
Yes, I know you were. We had a great time together. I spoke to some issues that affected the diaspora that were decisions being made by the government of Israel. I'll just give you one example.
Please.
You hope that diaspora Jews would consider bringing their daughters to celebrate their bat mitzvah at the Kotel.
Right.
But for protesters and members of the Jewish community to disrupt that just was abhorrent to me.
Sure.
And so I spoke out about the egalitarian prayer space so that the hope of the Jewish community wanting to come to be with the community in Israel would not be thwarted.
So you're somebody who does not enjoy the spotlight. Why do you think you're so uncomfortable in those moments? Because I understand, you know, there's humility, but then there's, you know, wanting to disappear when people are talking about you.
And what
do you think that's about?
I don't want to be thanked for what I think is my responsibility. Maybe that's what it is. Like people will say, you know, I'll never be able to be the kind of leader you've been. Yes, you will. It's all our responsibility. It's just I do it my way. So I think it makes me uncomfortable being recognized for what I truly believe is what I was born to do and what I was born to take on as a Jew, as a woman, as a mother, as a daughter. It's just who I am. So don't thank me for that.
I'll tell you, but I feel like we could dig a little deeper.
Maybe if you thank me, you'll think it's not your responsibility. Maybe that's what it is.
That's interesting.
Don't thank me for something you should be doing.
I love that. Are you surprised that of your 5 kids, I ended up being the public Jewish one?
You know, no. And the reason I'll say that is because you used to always geschrei the fact that you were a natural born leader. Like whenever it'd go, oh, Joni, you have to do this. You're the leader. Or if you don't follow this rule and end up in detention, everybody else will think it's okay because you're a natural leader. And I know you sort of push back against that, but I've known it. since you were born. So the fact that you are using it now in this way, no, it's not a big surprise to me. I also saw you at camp and I saw what those camp friendships meant to you and what your day school friendships meant to you and what family means to you. And I think this is an expression of all of that. And by the way, you're really good at it.
Thank you.
So I'm glad you used your skills in the same way I've used my skills on behalf of the Jewish people. I'm deeply grateful for that. I'm proud of you.
Thank you, Mom.
You bet.
Can you point to anything that you've learned from the pod over the past 8 months?
Oh my gosh. It is the joyous part of my week. If you ask me one thing that I have repeated, maybe it won't be what you would imagine.
No, I'm interested.
What Dara said about we are a people who kiss books.
Right.
I found that one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. I kiss a Jewish book when it falls on the floor and when right. I leave shul. I never thought about it till Dara said it. What a beautiful thing we are that we kiss books.
Yeah. This past January, you received the Israeli Presidential Medal of Honor from President Herzog, a non-citizen of Israel, receiving this award. And you were the only one receiving who was asked to speak at the award ceremony. It means you're the MVP. What did that mean to you truly to receive that honor?
I don't say this lightly. I enjoy a deep and close friendship with President Herzog and his wife. And I think that is one of the biggest gifts of my Jewish leadership, is my relationship with them. So if you ask me what that meant to me, the phone call from President Herzog to me telling me that I had won that award was probably the most precious moment of all. I thought he was going to ask me to do something on behalf of the Jewish people. In my wildest, wildest dreams, I never thought I would get that phone call. The execution of that at that ceremony was a deep honor and very beautiful. But the moment of that phone call and being able to share that with my children and my husband was the most precious part of that honor.
That's so nice. When receiving that award, you highlighted the importance of diaspora Jews taking on leadership roles. Interestingly, and I want to get your take on this, we had Jason Robert Brown on the show, and something he said was, look, not everybody is a leader. It's a leader. It's a personality trait. Some people are terrified, and their body like literally has a chemical reaction to being put into those moments. They don't want it. What's your take on that?
I remember that well, and I actually took a lot of comfort from what he said in forming the answer I'm going to tell you right now, which is, how do you define leadership? I'm leading on a grand scale.
Right.
I think leadership is inviting your kids to Shabbat dinner and saying once a month, commit to it.
Right.
I think leadership is you have or witness a Jew hate moment and you don't walk away from it, but you walk towards it. You don't have to do that on a grand scale. Mm-hmm. You can do it when somebody comments on your Instagram in a nasty way and you try to do a back and forth with that person. That's your own personal moment of leadership.
Maybe just don't do it if they're talking about Rachel Zegler.
Maybe not, Jonah. I'm glad you can say that with laughter. I think leadership is defined in many, many, many different ways. And everybody isn't meant to do it on a public setting.
Yeah.
But everybody can do it from the comfort of their own home. Literally everyone.
I happen to agree with you in that regard. I say that all the time, that it's just about leading in your own lane, in your own sphere of influence.
I used to say this long ago when I was the chair of women's philanthropy in Los Angeles. Women would change out of their workout clothes and get in a formal attire to come to an event and then change back and get in carpool line. And I would say as my closing remarks, don't change your clothes. Get in the carpool line, walk into the lobby of your day school and have somebody ask you, gosh, you're dressed so nicely. Why? And say, I went to a Jewish event. That's leadership.
Yeah.
Just do that.
Right, right. What is your call to action to everybody listening, old and young, Jews and allies alike, in this moment? What do you want to impart as the final bit of advice for season one of being Jewish?
Lead. Lead in just the way you've just talked about. Lead however it is, but you don't have the luxury to be quiet. Lead in what matters the most to you. If you are the product of Jewish summer camp, lead. Get someone else to go to Jewish summer camp. Tell your friend who goes to a non-Jewish private or public school to join your kid at Jewish summer camp. Lead in fighting Jew hate. Every one of us has to fight Jew hate. We're in a moment. So I don't care how you do it. Just do it. And if you have the resources, give. You have to give. You can give to lots of things. You can give to the things that matter to you. Our family is very supportive of the research against multiple sclerosis because it matters to us. That doesn't mean you can't be an and giver. Everybody's got to be an and giver right now. You've got to give to what matters to you, and you have to give Jewishly, and you have to do both.
Great advice. Great words of wisdom. Mom, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This has been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for bringing us home.
Thank you, Jonah.
Guys, that was my mom. Isn't she amazing? Thank you, Mom, for being here. And thanks again to Jeff and Leslie Woolman for sponsoring this very special episode. Speaking of amazing, I want to give a huge shout out to everybody who makes being Jewish possible week in and week out. All of the incredible guests who have shared their time and their wisdom with us all season long, the studio owners and technicians in LA, New York, Philly, Israel, and Detroit, the badass Jewish women on my team who I've spoken about before, my YouTube guys, the production team at Rainbow Creative, my designer, my token Israeli, my kids who love and support me even when I'm locked in my office or out of town, and of course, my wife, Courtney. Double weekly shout out to Courtney for being the best partner a guy could ask for. I love you, honey. Thank you to all of you out there for being part of the BJJP community, whether you're brand new or have been tuning in since I launched this thing 8 months ago. An extra special thank you to my friends, family, and followers who never miss an episode, who text or email or DM me to let me know how much you love the show, what you're taking away from it, and what it means to you. Your feedback and love and support throughout this process have truly meant so much to me. I screenshot and I save everything. Please never stop. This journey into podcast land has been life-changing, and reaching this end-of-the-season milestone with all of you is a blessing. And in fact, it definitely feels like a Shehechianu-worthy moment to me. The Shehechianu is a prayer we say on special occasions, momentous life events, a way of expressing gratitude that we have been fortunate enough to reach this moment. So if you know it, please join me. If you don't, just say Amen at the end. You're a part of this too. Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu melech ha'olam, shehecheyanu, v'kiyamanu, v'higiyanu, lazman hazeh. Amen. A few last bits of business before I let you go. Next week, we are launching two, count them, two new formats of being Jewish. Starting next Tuesday, we'll be releasing a new series called 30-Minute Mensches. Same host, same idea, but shorter, more focused conversations with an even more diverse plethora of Jewish professionals, starting with Israel's current special envoy for combating anti-Semitism, Michal Kotler-Wunsch. 30-Minute Mensches will be available on audio and YouTube only, so if you're a JBS viewer, make sure you head to beingjewishpodcast.com and click Watch Now or Listen Now, depending on your preference, then subscribe to Being Jewish so you don't miss out on the action. And starting next Friday, we'll be launching our new Best of Being Jewish series. We've taken all the best moments, lessons, and conversations, broken them down into themes like the Black Jewish connection, deconstructing Jew hate, and Jewish wisdom. We're putting them together for you. It's basically like Cliff Notes version of season one. So you're going to love it, whether it's brand new to you or a reintroduction to fantastic content you forgot about months ago. And if you haven't yet, make sure you're signed up for my newsletter and following both me and the show account on social media so you don't miss any of our summer updates or announcements about season two. Again, you can find all of that at beingjewishpodcast.com as well. Only one thing left to say. That's it for me, folks. I'll see y'all right back here for the next unforgettable season of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Plath.
Big ups to everyone who makes this show possible every week. My executive producer, Matthew Jones, story producer, Sean Livyashvili, and editor, Mike O'Brien of Rainbow Creative, consulting producer, Bethany Mandel, research associate, Samantha Greenwald, my amazing executive assistant, Josie Rothschild, social media manager, Yuval Yosha, and graphic designer extraordinaire, Noah Bell. Most of all, thanks to you, dear listeners, you even stuck around to listen to all these credits. Man, I freaking love you guys.